sabrosura pa ti keke.
Hello everyone, this is Pam, the Cafe con Pam, the bilingual podcast that features Latine and people of the global majority who break barriers, change lives, and make this world a better place. Welcome to episode 356 of Cafe con Pam. Today, we have a conversation with Andrew Boriga. Andrew grew up in the Bronx and now lives in Miami with his wife, two kids, and cute dog. His writing has appeared in the New York Times, The New Yorker, and The Atlantic, and has been awarded prizes by Cornell University, the University of Miami, the Susquehanna Review, and the Meichner Foundation. Andrew attended the Tin House Writers Workshop and has taught writing to college students, elementary school students, and incarcerated adults. Victim is his debut novel and was published a little bit back in March. Listeners, this conversation with Andrew was a joy because we explored the book. One of my favorite things about the book, as you will hear, is the characters. So I won't give you a lot in this intro, but I really think exploring the trajectory of writers, as we have interviewed several in the last few years, is always fascinating to me because everyone goes through a different process. In the case of Andrew, he started in journalism, and then it's really cool to hear how long this book took to write, the depths of the characters, and the various things that involve the birth of a novel, which we talk about in the episode. Y bueno, sin más, aquí está mi conversación con Andrew Boriga. Andrew, welcome to Café con Pam.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for coming on and for writing such an amazing book.
Thank you.
How are you? Where are you tuning in from today?
I'm doing well. I'm home here in Miami.
In Miami.
Yeah.
What's your heritage?
My heritage. So I am half Puerto Rican and half Polish. My mom is straight from the island, Puerto Rico, and met my father, who somehow a Polish, also like straight from Poland.
Wow.
Man happened to be in Puerto Rico, and they were working at the same hotel, and they met, and then we moved to the Bronx. So I was born in the Bronx, but they moved there together.
So they met in Puerto Rico?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And then they decided to go to New York.
They decided to go to New York, and I think I was born like a year later or something like that.
Why New York? Do you know?
I mean, we have family there. My mom had also, you know, like Puerto Rican, we make the migration back and forth so many times, you know. So she actually was born in Puerto Rico in Loíza and then went to elementary school for a little while in Brooklyn, went back to Puerto Rico. And then we had aunts, had cousins, things like that, who already live in there. So, you know, it's just been like a back and forth.
Right.
At least for a time. Now it's more like Florida. A lot of people don't go to New York as much.
I know.
Yeah.
Back then it was New York, huh?
Back then New York was the spot. Yeah, New York. I don't know. Like somehow Tampa became a place now. Like my whole Puerto Rican family is all up in Tampa now. Like they're just like.
From New York to Tampa.
Some of them from New York. Some of them from Puerto Rico, you know, straight from the island to Tampa. Orlando obviously is a big place as well. So it's just interesting, the migration pattern, how they change, you know, over time.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I love Puerto Rico. When I went to Puerto Rico, it was like, oh, it felt home. And I always wonder, because New York climate, it's very shocking.
Yeah, for sure. So,
I always wonder why New York, when there's Florida, which is much similar in climate.
I feel like it probably has something to do with the jobs and,
probably,
you know, the opportunities.
Yeah.
But yeah, the climate is, you know, it's a shock for most people.
It's very, very different. So for you growing up in New York, how often do you go back home or back to Puerto Rico?
I would go pretty frequently when I was younger. My mom would send me in the summers to spend time with my grandma, who was out there at the time, my aunt. Had some uncles out there as well, cousins. So I would say, I don't know, like probably from like 5 to 10 or so, 11, like I go back every summer. We go at least like once a year, you know. So I have very fond memories you know, there in the summertime. And then there was a period, you know, after that where we had, you know, there was a lot of violence where we're from and things that happened in my family with family members. And so
in New York?
In Puerto Rico. Yeah. So it just became a little more dangerous and we started not going as much. Mm. And then so there was a gap where I didn't go for a while. And then when I was 18, I went again. And then, you know, I actually got engaged there. I proposed to my wife in Puerto Rico. So I have like, you know, I've been a lot.
Yeah.
I've been a lot and it's been part of my life for sure. And I'm dying to take my kids. I haven't taken them yet, but
I was going to ask, have they gone? What?
They haven't. No, my wife is Colombian and they've been to Colombia and they haven't been to Puerto Rico. This beef, you know, there's like, you know, yeah. So I've got to correct the situation ASAP.
For sure. How old are the kids?
3 and a half and 1 and a half.
Oh, see, I mean, they'll remember.
Yeah. Right. You know, as I was saying, they still got time, you know, but we got to get a picture over there and I got to send it to the Puerto Rican family before they, you know, they come for me.
Totally. So thinking about going to grandma's house over the summers, I think that's a common thing for some immigrant kids, obviously not everyone.
Yeah.
And how was it for you to leave and then come back? As far as like your friends and being in the neighborhood, because in New York, you talk about New York a lot. How, I mean, it's tight, you know, the community is tight. And so leaving, was that a transition that was hard for you?
You know, I was so young that it wasn't for me. I think what was harder was that my relationship to the language was always so complicated because I understood way more Spanish than I spoke. And everyone in Puerto Rico didn't really speak English that well. So, it would be this situation where I'd get there and feel already sort of like limited in my capacity to express myself, you know? But at the same time, so excited and stimulated by everything I was taking in. So it was like a weird thing where I was like, you know, enjoying everything, but not being able to feel like I could participate fully, you know, at the same time. So that part was a little weird, or you know, it would be kind of like a struggle to deal with. But I love going there so much. You know, I mean, the food and just the culture and the food.
Yes, the food.
But yeah, I would say that part was a little weird. But I had a you know, my family was great, and they kind of ripped me about it for not speaking Spanish as well. But they would also work with me. And so I had cousins who didn't speak a lick of English and all they knew was 1, 2, 3. So they'd be like, Andrew Mark, 1, 2, my middle name is Mark. And my family calls me Andrew Mark. They're like, Andrew Mark, 1, 2, 3, go. 1, 2, 3, go. And I was like, all they knew. And so we made up these little games and stuff. You know, we still had a great time. It was cool. But yeah, no, I think growing up in the Bronx, so many people were Puerto Rican in my neighborhood that it wasn't weird to go back and forth, you know. It was pretty normal.
Totally. And I think, I don't know, it makes me think of how resilient kids like us are, because we get to, I mean, it's intricate. It's layered.
Yeah.
There's so many things that English only speaking kids don't experience. I mean, you're talking about a completely different food. I mean, being in the Bronx, there's probably a lot of familiarity, but it's like the climate, you know, traveling. Mm-hmm. It's a long-ish type of flight. What is it? 4 hours?
Nah, it was like maybe three. I don't remember. Maybe three and a half. Maybe, I guess around four, maybe. Yeah.
But I mean, you know.
Yeah.
It's the culture. It's even though you may have the same type of food, it's still different.
Yeah. No, it's super different. Yeah, it's super different. Life out there was, you know. I mean, also, I think it was interesting. I remember probably mostly like the town we're from in Loíza's, you know, it's a very important town culturally. It's one of the first free like black settlements in the island. So there's a lot of bomba music there. There's a lot of like important art and like folklore and everything there. You know, but it's also, you know, the island in general is just poorer than the United States, right? So that was something I remember too, is like going back from the Bronx to there and then come back home and be like, damn, like I got it good, you know. Like we got AC, we got, you know, the TVs, like the lights don't go out, the water don't go out, like, you know. So there was like, I think I probably remember that more than anything, is the understanding that I already like, I kind of coming from there and going back and forth, like, I have it good, you know?
Did you ever feel survivor's guilt?
About, like, from the Puerto Rican side of pursuit?
Yeah, like, going back, like, I'm going back to my nice little world.
Nah, because I was so young, I didn't really understand what that was. You know, I experienced that later on when I went from the Bronx to college, you know, because then I kind of, like, had more of a grounding. But I was a kid. I was like, you know, I was like focused on like Pokemon cards and stuff like that. Like I was, you know, yeah, having fun with my cousins. Yeah, you know, like we were having fun. So I was thinking about all that.
Let's talk about college. Did your mom instill like you need to go to college? How did you decide that you wanted to go to college?
She went to college. She went to college later. She had started in college, had me, and then later on went back to finish her degree sometime later. And I believe, I believe she had, you know, she made it clear that I should go to college, but she never put like, you got to go here, you got to go to this type of school type of thing on me. You know, that, I think it was more like just, you're staying, stay out of trouble, like go to school, do something. You know what I mean? And so I was actually a track runner. I used to run cross country and indoor and outdoor track, and I was pretty good at cross country. And so I was getting recruited for these Division II schools. Yeah. So in my mind, I was just going to go to like whatever school paid me a little bit to run. That was my plan, basically. And she was cool with that. And then I ended up getting into, you know, winning some scholarships when I was a senior and junior, and sort of getting mentors who helped me aim like a little higher for places like Cornell, where I ended up going, where I had no, you know, that was never in my mind to go to a school like that. But it was more like I was, you know, put around these guidance counselors and things who were helping me to, you know, aim a little higher, which I'm glad they did because it was, you know, that was a big deal. My mother was very excited and happy when I got into Cornell, but I don't think she was necessarily like, that's, you got to go there. Yeah. She didn't think I was going to end up there, you know, when I was like a freshman or whatever.
Let's take a pause and acknowledge mentors, because many times kids like us, where our parents are like, well, there's opportunities, you know, go and you have access to them, but they don't necessarily have the resources. They don't have the knowledge. I mean, you know, they may not have tools to give you. And so it's great that you found mentors and counselors that saw and chose to give you that chance, which is awesome.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I'm extremely grateful to them. I'm still in touch with a lot of them now. You know, when the book came out, I like sent it to all of them and they were so happy. You know, I think, yeah, because, you know, that was basically the experience. My mother, you know, was like, go to school and, you know, you should go to school. But there were all these things that we didn't understand, all these forms and like scholarships and like recommendations you're supposed to get and all this kind of stuff. And so having people to kind of walk me through that and explain, do, you know, go through it this way, you know, do these types of things. Here's how you study for the SAT, you know, these types of things that I hadn't really, you know, received before. And a lot of people don't get that, helped me tremendously. So, yeah.
Totally. So you make it to Cornell. How does Andrew, a kid from the Bronx, showing up to Cornell University, what happened?
it was a culture shock, complete culture shock. You know, I got there, I was excited to go, you know, excited. I never thought, again, I never think I was going to be like an Ivy League kid. You know, I just didn't see myself that way. So, so that was pretty cool in itself. And then, but then I got there and, you know, I had only previously gone like the diversity day visit. They get all the kids from the city, from like the Brooklyn, the Bronx, Queens or whatever, throw you on a bus and you take you up there. And then everyone who you hang out with is also kids from the city who look like you and from similar culture. So you just assume like, oh, everyone, the whole school is like this. Yeah. I'm like, oh, this is great. You know, it's going to be dope. And then I got there and I saw like the rest of the school, which is like 90% of the school basically, is not like that. And it was, you know, it was a complete culture shock because, you know, class level, like these are the top of the top, you know, in terms of wealth and, you know, things like that. And so, it was a very weird experience because I, you know, I tell people all the time, like, I didn't even think of myself as like poor until I got to Cornell, you know, and I met some of these kids and I was just like, you did what over the summer? You know, like how many houses you got? Like, yeah, you know, like, oh shit. So that was like the first time that I was like, oh, okay, we're on different playing fields over here. You know, I didn't really understand that. So yeah, there was a lot culturally, there was a lot to navigate. Academically, you know, I thought I had gone to pretty good. I went to mostly public schools, and then high school, I got a sponsorship to go to a Catholic school in the Bronx, and I won like the math award, and I was number three in the school, and I was like, you know, I'm pretty good at this like school stuff, you know, like I'm. And then I got there, and I was just like, yo, it was a whole different level. You know, math was crazy. Like I won the math award and I got like a 40 on my first math test. It was all these things were happening at the same time. So it was very overwhelming for me. Yeah.
Did you have someone to ask at that time that you could go back to and be like, why didn't you prep me for this?
I mean, I had those mentors from from my high school programs. And I think I reached out to them a couple times, you know, just like, I mean, I tried to drop out. Right. So that was for the first year. I was like, I'm dropping out. I can't do this. I'm out of here. And I did reach out to try and get some help from them. And I think the biggest thing that communicated to me was like, this is an adjustment period. Like you got to just, you know, it's going to get better. It's going to get better. Which at the time I understand, but, or like now I understand, but right. At the time I was like, that's not helping me, bro. Like, I was like, this is bad. I'm depressed. You know, I've never been depressed in my life. This is bad.
Totally.
So yeah, it was hard, you know? And I think it wasn't until like my sophomore year where I started finding kind of mentors and people I go to in the Cornell community, professors, Latino professors mostly, who like saw me and were just like, all right, you need some help, kid, you know, and they kind of pulled me aside.
That's good.
So yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Because what did you do for your mental health?
I did go to therapy. That was the first time I'd ever gone. I think my freshman year I went and, you know, cause you get like free, I was a scholarship kid. So I got like the free healthcare package.
Nice.
And, I was like, yo, let me use this.
Yeah. Why not? Like,
see what this is about, you know? So it was interesting, you know, it was, my guy, the, therapist was a nice woman, but she was like a white woman from that area and like,
disconnected from reality.
Yeah. And like, I was trying to explain things about my background, my family, and it was like kind of going over. So, but you know, it was just kind of helpful to have somebody to talk to, I think, mm-hmm. and express some of these things. And I think also I opened up a lot more to my mother too, which was, that was a kind of a good byproduct of everything that had happened. You know, I had been, because I grew up, you know, my mother's a single mom and I was the oldest. I spent a lot of my time growing up, like kind of having a lot of responsibilities, taking care of my younger sisters, like working, like doing all these types of things. And so we had a relationship where it was hard for me to express when I felt, I don't know, like I was going through hardships, you know, because I just had it together for so long mm-hmm. that it was actually very hard for me to admit, like, I'm having trouble, you know, I'm having a problem here. Yeah. So, but once I got that through to her, and it wasn't because she wasn't listening, it was more because I didn't want to tell her. But when I finally did tell her, she became obviously a big support as well. And like we would talk a lot more, and she'd be like, you know, she always told me, she was like, if you want to leave, like if you need to leave, then leave. You know, like she was just like, your health is more important. Like it's cool you're in Ivy League school, but if you're gonna be, you know, depressed all the time, you're not gonna enjoy yourself, then you know, do what you got to do. So, it was good to have that understanding and sort of like, you know, back home, people were not gonna, like, there was no pressure. Like, you got to get this degree, you know, you got to stay here. Like, it was more like, we're proud of you no matter what, you know?
When was Javier born?
Javier. So he was born probably my sophomore year in college.
In college, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. College was, you know, Cornell, before Cornell, I had decided I want to be a writer when I was about 16, but I focused on journalism first. And that was mostly because I didn't really understand what it meant to write a novel or be a novelist or a fiction writer, you know? And so I focused on that. And then when I got to college, I started taking these creative writing courses and writing these little short stories. And that was where I started to play with this idea of a character named Javi, you know, similar background as me, and kind of like putting him in different situations. And a lot of those early stories, you know, had earlier versions of Javi. I think I had his name differently in some different points. The name kind of coalesced later on, but it was basically him. So I've been playing with him in that world that's in the novel Victim now is, you know, that's since whatever that was, 2011, 2010. It's been a long time.
It's a while ago, over 10 years ago. So did you know that Javier eventually was going to make it to a book, or were you just writing stories?
I was just writing stories in the beginning. Mostly it was because you were assigned stories, right? In these classes, you had to write a short story in 2 weeks. So that just gave me a prompt to go and see what I could do. And then I did that a bunch of times in a row. And then I started to learn how to make the stories better, you know, through revising, through workshop, started submitting the stories to awards on campus, and it won a bunch of those awards on campus. So then I was like, okay, like this is going pretty well. Like, you know, like I was getting a good response from my teachers, from my students, I mean, not my students, my classmates. And it just gave me more confidence to kind of like pursue it. And so by the time I did graduate, by the time I was a senior, by that point I had it in my mind, like, I want to write a novel. I want to write a book about, you know, a character like Javi, about this kind of world that I was already playing with in the Bronx. You know, but it was a slow process. I didn't necessarily start thinking all that. I was just like, let me write the story for class and see how it goes.
When was Giovanni Gio born?
Gio was also born around that time.
Okay.
You know, yeah. So like I've been playing with these characters for like a long time, especially Gio and Javi. They were the first ones. You know, Javi was obviously based off of me, but Gio was, you know, talking about survivor's guilt, kind of like going back to that, but Gio was based off of these friends that I had growing up who, you know, where I was on this path going to an Ivy League school in Cornell and like writing for newspapers and things. These kids who we grew up with, you know, in the same neighborhood, going to the same schools, you know, some of them were involved in drugs or gangs. Some of them already been in and out of jail. Like, so they had taken these very different paths in life. And a lot of my first writing, like fictional writing, was trying to grapple with that. Like, I look back now and I read it and I understand that that's really what I was trying to, you know, get at a little bit. It's like this, the survivor's guilt that I had of basically how did I end up here? And they ended up there. Yeah. We came from the same place. And to my mind, we weren't all that different, you know? So I think, you know, I was just trying to like parse that out in a story. And so Gio always represented those friends, you know, this person who's like talented, you know, smart, but also kind of like falls under the wrong influences.
Yeah. Like the people that were at the wrong place at the wrong time.
Yeah. I mean, some of that, but also, you know, I think trying to get at this idea, you know, a lot of those friends I had, it wasn't just that, it was also kind of, they were looking for communities, like belonging in some way.
Yeah.
And a lot of times, like, you know, these gangs or these, like, you know, people who from the outside, like, don't have your best interest in heart, they can make you feel accepted, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think for the kids that I knew, a lot of it was more so was that, you know, they wanted to feel accepted, like they belong, like they had some kind of status, you know? And so a lot of, you know, kind of went that way.
Oof, so deep.
Yeah.
Well, we could explore that, but let's take a quick coffee break.
Okay.
So, Andrew, do you drink coffee?
I do. I'm drinking one now.
Yay. Wait, but it's 3:00 your time, and you're drinking coffee right now?
Yeah, but that's cool. I drink all day. Yeah, no, that's a problem. Yeah.
But does it affect you?
No, it has zero effect. I could drink this right now and go to sleep.
Wow. So you're like my brother. My brother literally can drink coffee like water and he'll have zero, like nothing.
Yeah.
Well, that's good. I'm jealous of people like you because I do love coffee, but my cutoff is like 2 p.m. max. And that's very much pushing it, because that means that I won't sleep.
Mm-hmm. I know that. My wife is like that.
Oh, and she's Colombian, so oof.
Yeah.
That's probably more unfortunate, because Colombian coffee is great.
So good.
Yeah. So how do you drink your coffee?
So I have a little coffee machine in the house now, and I make my own like cafe con leche, like basically espresso and then the foam milk on top. Depending on the day, I mostly go to like almond milk, you know, I'm trying to keep off the dad bod, but every now and then I go with the whole milk too. When I go to the store, like when I go to the little ventanitas and stuff in Miami, I always get it with the whole milk. So I feel like they're going to look at me crazy if I ask for almond milk.
Oh yeah, you know? For sure.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, you can't. No.
I'm like, what?
Yeah, who are you? A tourist?
Yeah.
Great. So you make it. Do you have a favorite coffee shop that you support? Local?
Honestly, there's so many great ones in Miami, and it's not like they're not you know, kind of like fancy shops. It's like little ventanitas. Like it's like they're called like, you know, Rinconcito number 72 or something. You know what I mean? Like these little places.
Yes.
And you just go to the window and it's like, there's no Wi-Fi. There's no music playing in the background. It's just like usually a woman like giving you a stink eye. What do you want? You know, and then the coffee is fucking incredible.
Yes.
So yeah, there's a few places I go to like that around my area. One of them that I'm really into now is Pinecrest Bakery, which if you're in Miami, you probably know, but their coffee is incredible. So.
Do you get almond milk there?
No. Okay.
You keep it at home.
They throw me out. Yeah, no. Just like.
Nice. Yeah. One thing I learned about Miami is when you get coffee and you get Cuban coffee specifically,
yeah,
it's meant to be shared.
You know, my wife says this to me all the time because I think it's what? It's the colada? No, the cortaditos, one of the little cups.
Yeah, the little cups. Yep.
I never get that. I always get the large cafe con leche. And I'm like, the other day she was like, oh, let's get that and share. And I was like, I'm going to get the large.
Get your own.
I want my own big one.
Nice.
So I'm not a great representative for that mindset, but that is definitely happens a lot in Miami. You see the, you know, people coming out with the little cups and they're going to take it to the
Señores, no? Like they,
and
they play like
construction
chess.
Sites. They mm-hmm. do it. Yeah. You see it all the time. Sometimes my barbers here will just randomly be like, yo, you want some, you know? So.
But you get your own.
Yeah. Nice. I know. I feel bad. I feel embarrassed. I'm selfish like that.
That's okay. Hey, coffee doesn't affect you. I could not drink the cubanos, like the shareable ones, all by myself because I would legit bounce up and down.
I mean, I feel like you spontaneously combust. I think you're not.
Yeah, exactly.
I think like you're not supposed to do. I wouldn't even take that to the face. That's like a lot.
Yeah,
it's a lot.
It is a lot of caffeine, but delicious nonetheless. Coffee is such a community also. Like
it is
ritualistic.
I love coffee.
Yeah, same.
I'm a huge fan. Yeah.
Yeah, tea could be too, but I think culturally for Latinos, coffee is like a thing. I think tea is more like healing, you know, like.
Yeah, I was going to say like tea is like when I'm sick, I'm like, all right, yes. I'll drink tea, but willingly, like on a normal day. No.
Yeah, for sure. All right, well, let's get back to the show. We're going to fast forward now. You wrote a book called Victim.
Yes.
Great book.
Thank you.
Were you ever, as you were writing it, because one, it took a long time. So you mentioned that you were in college when you started writing the stories about Javier, not necessarily with the thought of this becoming a novel, and he was already in existence. How much of Javi do you have is part of you? How much of Giovanni is part of you? Are there parts of you within both, within one?
Yeah, I would say within both, for sure. You know, I love the two of them together in the book because they play off of each other so well. And I feel like they represent, like, they're from the same area, but they represent these two different perspectives and, like, way of looking at life and, like, way of moving through life.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like I'm constantly, like, doing a little, like I'm a bit of both and trying to figure out the right balance point or whatever, you know. Gio is kind of more in touch with like his neighborhood, the streets, like his that way of life there. And then Javi's the more like ambitious, you know, striver type, and trying to sort of better, quote unquote, better himself and learn these fancy terms and way of speaking and dressing and all these things. Yeah, so I feel like a little bit of both. I would say Javi, though, the parts of him that are similar to me, I mean, I think obviously the penchant for writing, being interested in being a writer so young and sort of like being told that was something that happened to me in elementary school. I think as early as elementary school, people, my teachers were like, you know, you could write, you should do something like this, you should do something with this talent. You know, so that, and I think for a time in my life too, I was very focused on this idea of success, but this like very external version of it that had nothing to do with actually writing a good book. It was more like, you know, social media status or, you know, likes and followers and things like that. So I did pull from parts of that, you know, to kind of feed into Javi and play it up a little bit more. And then obviously the fact that I was a journalist for a long time as well, you know, and working in this media world and writing about and victim. I would say where Javi differs is, you know, I kind of think of him as like this alternative version of myself kind of, and where when I was in the media and I started to get these story assignments that were, or pitches that were based on writing about my own background, a trauma, my own like, or things that are happening in my community or some people similar to me. And that was like all I was getting. I started to kind of pull back because I started to feel like I was being pigeonholed a little bit. Yes. As a writer. Whereas Javi, you know, where he's different from me is like, he kind of like understood that market and instead of pulling back, like leaned all the way in and started
capitalized.
Yeah, right. Exactly. He kind of just like gave the market what they wanted, gave it to them better with more spin on it.
And twisted it a little bit, a lot of it.
And then twisted a little bit, twisted a lot, you know, and so but that was all fun to do because it's like, it's a nice departure for me, but it's also, I could imagine myself if I went down the same rabbit hole that he goes down to maybe feel tempted to do those types of things, you know, so it was a fun kind of experience to imagine this like alternative version of myself where I didn't pull back and I just like leaned in, and that was what Javi was.
I love that. And I think, I mean, it's really refreshing to see that possibility, which I think, I'm sure it's happened in real life, you know, and seeing the depths of the character and so many layers that were presented as you were writing it. And because it's so close also to your experience, did you ever think that people were going to then start questioning Andrew? Like, oh, did Andrew ever do that?
Yeah. I figured I was going to get that. And I have a couple times.
Yes.
Yeah. Like, so I kind of understood that. And I think, you know, it took a while for me to land on the premise where Javi is this, you know, journalist, columnist kind of making things up, right? Making up stories of injustice that happened to him or things that, you know, or like over elaborating on things that maybe were slightly true. And when I did, I liked that idea so much and I thought it worked so well for the book that I was trying to write that I kind of just decided to come to like an understanding with myself. Like, I know that I didn't do this stuff. There's going to be a few people who maybe think it. And like, I can't do anything about that. You know what I mean? Like, it is what it is, but yeah. This feels fun. It feels, you know, fresh and interesting. And it's like a way of getting at issues of identity and like commodification and diversity that I think a lot of novels are trying to get at in the last few years. But I think for me, we're kind of lacking sometimes because the protagonist or the person of color at the center of the story would never seem to be allowed to like do bad things or like, mm-hmm. you know, make mistakes, you know what I mean? And so I was like, I don't want to limit him in that way. And if the trade-off is that some people might think he's me, then like, you know, so be it.
That's the other thing that it's great about the main character not being necessarily the hero of the story.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's like it almost shows the various layers that characters could have, you know, the good things, and also that we can do things that may not turn out to be so well, because at the time of doing them, they will benefit us, but then eventually mm-hmm. the truth comes out.
Yeah. I mean, he's complicated, right? You know, I think human beings are complicated, and fiction, I love reading fiction where characters, you know, sometimes you love them, sometimes you hate them.
Yeah.
And you know, they feel like real people. I mean, the people I love in my life, that's how it is. Like, I don't love them. Like, I love them, but then there's times where it's like, you're so annoying, you know, like, but you still love them. You know what I mean? So it's like, I don't know. It's, to me, it feels normal to have a character like that.
Totally. And what I love about Giovanni, for example, on the other end, is the realness that he brings, and how it's written. This character, I think it's written beautifully, how he never really could stop being Giovanni, you know? Like, I could hear New York City in Gio.
I love that.
And so was that something that, as a writer, because you had to write how Gio would talk, was that something that was challenging for you?
No, because I think my own, like, mental, like, the way I speak in my mind is like, you know what I mean? Like my filter is still like so much, like, I was so Bronx. Like, I lived in there for 25 years, the same building, same neighborhood. Like, I didn't really go anywhere. Like, so like my, like, as you know, learned and these degrees are in the book I have, like, I still filter the world kind of through that way. Mm. And so Gio was actually so much fun to write because he was like tapping into this, I don't know, younger, pure Bronx version of myself, you know, like my friends and I, and the way we talk to each other and joke with each other. And just like, you know, like, so I loved writing him so much, so much so that for a while I tried to make him the main character.
Oh, that would have been a fun plot twist.
Yeah. I tried to make it work, but it just like, it didn't, you know, the book kept telling me Javi was the main person.
Yeah.
I had to make Javi a little different, but yeah, no, that part was, to me, was fun and like, I don't want to say easy, but you know, I don't know, cathartic almost. Cause like, that's, I love the way people in the Bronx talk.
It's really enjoyable.
Yeah. You know, and it's like, and I always wanted to capture that in a book, because it's like, when I read New York books, I'm like, this is not how people talk.
Right. Right. I mean? Like, totally. Yeah. And I have friends from New York, and there's nothing like a New York accent. Like, you know, I'm always like, tell me you want coffee.
Yeah.
It's great. And so I could, as I was reading Giovanni's lines, I'm like, oh, it was very transportative. Is that a word? It would take me there.
Yeah.
For sure. How love fun. That. So how many iterations of Victim did you come up with?
Oh man, I lost count. I think at least 5 or 6 full, like, rewrites, different plot, same character, same world, but different plot, different themes. So yeah, a lot. I mean, there's thousands of pages I threw away.
Wow. Will you use those at some point, or they're just like gone into the abyss of words?
You know, the other day I put a short story together of this section about Orchard Beach in the Bronx that I always loved, and that didn't make it into the novel. And it was like a self-contained thing. So I have a story about that coming out. And so I might have maybe a couple more like stories here and there of things that like never made it in. But the vast majority of it is just going to stay in some Word doc that I'm going to forget about.
For sure. How did you know Victim was ready for the world, given that it took a minute? Which, you're not the first author that I interview that had a long process in a book. So I'm curious for yours.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard, you know. I mean, shout out to the people who do it in like 2 or 3 years.
Yeah,
it's hard, you know. It's very hard, especially your first book. I think for a big chunk of the time, I was just learning what does it mean to write a book. What goes into that, you know? And like, how do you have a plot? How do you mm-hmm. Create arcs for these characters? You know, all these things that I had to learn. So a big chunk of it was that. But I think in terms of knowing Victim was ready, I got it to a point where, you know, I read it back and thought to myself, there's nothing else that I can think of to add to make this better. And anything I do change from here on out will probably make it worse. You know?
So it was like you knew the content was enough.
Yeah. Like I didn't think it was perfect. I knew that for me, this is the best I can do right now, you know? Cause I would read previous versions, you know, write it, take a break, read it. And as I was reading, be like, this is not it, you know? And like, I would try to convince myself, but I would know in my heart, like it wasn't it, you know, there was something missing. It just wasn't ready. And that final version before we sent it out to publishers and stuff, myself and my agent also, you know, we agreed like, all right, this is it, you know, like, let's go with this. So
nice. What was the hardest part of from writing to publication and now you're touring it for aspiring authors? Yeah.
The hardest part. That's a great question. I mean, the writing was definitely, was 10 years. Yeah. Those 10 years were difficult. I think I started having fun the last 2 years and, you know, and that's something I've been focusing on a lot now as I'm trying to work on a second book is to have fun and focus on or really think deeply about what it is I'm writing or subjects or characters that feel fun to me in the moment, because I've kind of realized like if I'm enjoying myself on the page, then the reader is more likely to.
Yeah.
Whereas there were so many years where I was writing a version of this book and I was not having fun. And it just, you know, people would like it, but there'd be things missing and they'd kind of, you know, it wasn't hitting the way that I was hoping it would.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, the younger writers, it's like, yeah, chase whatever feels fun to you in the moment to write, like kind of chase that feeling, even if it takes you to some weird places that you wouldn't imagine. I didn't imagine the book turning out the way it did. It changed a lot. But I kind of like let go and just like let it take me where it was trying to go, I think, probably this whole time.
And that makes me think, what did you have to let go of in order for you to have fun? Because when you talk about it taking 10 years and the last 2 years and is when you actually started having fun, what was it that you chose to release so that you could have fun?
Yeah. I think the biggest thing was just expectations, you know? For so long, I had this weird dream, like I had to publish a book by 27. For some reason, I just chose a number out of thin air. And
Saturn return time.
Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah, I don't know. It's just, I know like other writers had done it at that age. And like, I was just like 27, I got to do it by 27. And so, from 20 to 27, or whatever, I was so focused on doing it by 27, you know, and like putting on this pressure and like, it had to be perfect. I had to be, you know, all these things. And I think I was just thinking more about the reception of the book than the actual book itself, you know? And then it didn't happen at 27, it didn't happen at 28, 29. And I was just like, then I became a dad and I was like, I don't know if this thing's ever going to happen. And when I started to have fun is kind of when I stopped just placing expectations on myself. I was like, you know, maybe it will never happen, but I'm just going to write this thing for fun. See, you know, and that was like the last iteration of it. And that's ended up, you know, being the fastest version. I mean, I wrote it in like a year and a half and then we were selling it, you know? And so, that was a big lesson to me. It's just like, remove expectations, you know, stop thinking about what it's supposed to look like or supposed to do or who you're hoping is going to read it or all these things that you can't really control, you know?
And I wonder if it's because the topic of the book, it's something that's not been discussed so much, like leveraging the intersections that we carry.
Yeah, I think, well, you know, I landed on that like part of the book around that time. I think I had inklings of it before. But I think part of, along with the idea of, you know, chasing this expectations, I had this idea of who was going to read it or who was supposed to like the book and how I didn't want to offend them. I didn't want to like ruffle any feathers. And so these these issues, the idea of, you know, leveraging your trauma, you know, for example, for social media praise or for, you know, opportunities, or the idea of these publications, you know, sort of only, you know, looking for writers of color to do these types of stories.
Yes.
I had experienced it, and I was thinking about the stuff, and I was talking about it with friends and other writers, but I didn't feel like, I felt like if I wrote about it, it would be too, you know, controversial, or it would be too, you know, those people who I was trying to win.
It's real. It becomes a thing. If you write about it, then it's like, okay, it exists.
Yeah. You know, and like, because I hadn't seen it out there, it was like, yeah. You know, if you don't talk about it, like if someone hasn't talked about it yet, then you say, you can't say anything yet.
Right.
So talked about, you know what I mean? So there was, you know, and again, I'm trying to make sure that it's this type of book that I have in my mind and these type of people are going to like it. So I was like, I'm not going to do anything that's going to ruffle their feathers. And so I think when I finally let all that go and I was just like, I'm interested in this stuff. I want to write an interesting story around it with this character who's like leaning into it. And just go with it. Everything clicked into place.
Well, I'm glad you wrote it. It's a great book.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. And everyone should read it. So tell us where we can find it.
Yeah, it's Victim. It's out now. It's in all the bookstores. It's online. It's an audiobook. We just won an award for the audiobook version of the book.
What? So tell me more.
Yeah, I didn't read it. I didn't read it, but I think that's why we won the award. But this Anthony Ray Perez is his name. He's a voice actor.
Cubano from New York, I hope.
Miami. He's from Miami, actually. He's Cuban from Miami. He lives in California now, but he killed it. Like, he sounded just like the dude from the Bronx. And
wow, I'm gonna have to listen. I want to hear it.
Yeah, he's incredible. He did an amazing job. And so, so we just won an award for that. The book's everywhere. You can buy books.
Amazing. Where can we find you if people want to connect with you?
You can find me on Instagram and Twitter. My handles are Bory Writes, B-O-R-Y Writes. And I also have a Substack newsletter called Dwell. Thank you. I write about the, you know, kind of the journey to publishing this book and try and give people some like nuggets of things I learned along the way. Hopefully it can help them in their own writing journeys too.
Mm-hmm. I really liked your Substack on the things you learned from journalism. 10 things, I think.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. It's a lot of lessons.
Yeah, for sure. I tried to play with Substack. A lot of belief came through. I don't write enough.
Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting platform. I wrote a lot more before the book came out, and now it's been like probably going to go to once a month because it's just, I don't have the time as much. I'm trying to work on the second thing, but I really love it as a platform and just newsletters in general. It's a nice format that's different from like the frenetic energy on like Twitter or like Instagram and stuff. It's like a slower, you know, you digest what they've written. Kind of place.
I do like the Substack. So what can we expect from you next? You're working on a second book that you've teased a little bit.
Yeah.
Is it related to Victim or is it very different? You know, share what you can share.
Yeah, it's very different. You know, I think, you know, the things I'm touching on in Victim are, you know, issues that I was thinking about a lot from like 2013, 14 to when the book came out. And obsessed about, and I wrote it, and so I got everything I wanted to say in there, basically. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not anymore. And I think the new thing that I'm obsessed about, or just thinking a lot about, and listening to podcasts and reading books about, is like parenthood and fatherhood, and you know, like the modern day version of that. Like, what does that look like? What is it, quote unquote, supposed to look like? You know, there's like so many interesting things happening, I think, right now culturally about expectations of a man or of a dad or a father, and a lot of things are in flux, and I feel it going through my early childhood years with my kids, and so I'm trying to write a fictional story kind of about a character going through that transition as well, and hopefully it'll have some of the entertaining and funny, you know, humorous aspects that Victim does, because I that's important to me, but we'll see. It's so early on.
How fun. I can't wait to read that one. let us know when that one comes out.
Hopefully not 10 years.
I was going to say, is it going to take that long?
I hope not.
Your really kids are going to graduate from high school and that's going to be the, no.
I know. Like, yeah.
Let's not wait that long. Last few questions. Do you have a remedio that you want to share with us?
Oof. I mean, Vicks. it's so like cliche, but it's true, you know, like it's like for your nose, you have stuffiness, you got a cough, you rub it on your chest, you know, it's calming.
It's all the things.
Yeah. Vicks is pretty great.
Vicks is pretty great. Do you have a quote or mantra that you live by?
Something that is like circling my mind now. And I don't know if it's a core mantra, but it's something I think about a lot. It's like this idea of, I think I heard it like in a rap song, like closed mouth, don't get fed. You know, and like, I think to me, it means like putting yourself out there, you know? I think as a writer, as a creator, I think a big hindrance or like, you know, hurdle that people have to get over is actually like, it's not just writing the thing or creating the thing. It's like putting it out there for consumption or for people to have judgment on and that fear. And so for me, it's more like, if I want to be a writer, if I want to be read and have people enjoy the work or pass it on or whatever, or find an audience, you know, I have to put it out there and sort of like be comfortable with whatever judgment might come your way. Because, you know, if you just stay quiet, like no one will ever know what it is you're up to.
Totally. And that's really paralyzing for a lot of people, actually.
Yeah, for sure.
As someone who, for me, as a coach and a trauma-informed coach, there's a lot of things that we carry in the body that feel familiar to the potential consequences of putting ourselves out there. And so I think that's why a lot of people just choose not to, because mm-hmm. the feeling might be way too familiar.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of talent that goes unnoticed.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's scary to put yourself out there.
For sure. How did you overcome it?
You know, I really wanted to publish a novel. You know, I really wanted to kind of be in conversation with some of the amazing books that I've loved, you know, mm-hmm. that have inspired me. And so I think a big part of it was just seeing other writers do it that I admire, you know. Mm. Just like understanding that they went through it, and it's like, all right, if they can do it, then I can do it, you know.
For sure.
Yeah.
Just kind of like focusing on the goal before, more so than the consequence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like exactly.
Approach. Okay, last one. Do you have a productivity tip, trick, or tool that you want to share with us?
Consistency. That's like the only thing I got, you know. I, you know, me personally, I wake up early, like 5 to 7, Monday through Friday. And I sit there, you know, now it's my dining table because my kids took over the room that used to be my writing room. But you know, so it's not glamorous by any means. Yeah. You know, I'm like quietly trying to make a coffee while they're sleeping, but you know, but what matters is the like showing up, you know, just being mm-hmm. consistent. And that's something I learned during the process of writing Victim. Is even though it was 10 years of a grind, I was, for those 10 years, for the most part, being very consistent about showing up and writing and working on the book and banging my head on the wall. And that pays off, you know, eventually, even if it takes longer than you hope it would, it does pay off.
I agree. And consistent requires a level of discipline, which sometimes that's really hard.
Yeah.
It's doable for sure. Well, Andrew, thank you so much for coming to Café con Pam. This was super fun.
Thank you so much for having me. Yeah, I had a really great time.
Yay. And I hope people definitely do buy Victim. I will have links in the show notes to Bookshop because we like to support local bookstores.
Yeah, they're awesome.
So definitely, I will have the book linked from Bookshop. And if you have a local bookstore, you can always go and request it. And even from your local library, it's another thing that people can do. If yes. you may not have possibility to buy the book, you can go to your local library and request for them to bring copies, because that also helps the authors, right?
I love, yeah, like I'm so cool with people going to the library to get it. I'm a library kid. I was always getting books from the library. So I like love to see it when people are like ordering it from the library. So yeah, please.
Yay. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
And that was it, listeners. I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Andrew. I hope you got inspired a little bit. If you have been thinking about writing, perhaps you have some stories that they want to be known, they want to come out into the world, definitely explore that option, because why not? I think Andrew's story was one to inspire us to follow the path and do what it is that we are pushed and pulled to do. As you know, this, as you heard, this book took 10 years to write. And again, this is not the first time I hear from a writer that it took this long for a book to come out into the world. Sin embargo, I think the fact that Andrew gave himself permission to explore and to also shift the characters and give all the depth to each one of the characters, and we only talked about two, it's really powerful. And also the topic, definitely check out Victim. Buy it at your local bookstore. Like we shared in the episode, if you don't have the means, perhaps maybe this is not within your budget to buy a book, totally understandable, go to your local library. Libraries are really cool, and ask for them to bring books. That's really helpful for authors, because when libraries bring in books, then more people get to explore them as well. And so libraries are cool. Listeners, thank you so much for being here. If this is your first time, welcome to Café con Pam. I hope you come back and you stay. Please do subscribe, follow, hit the bell. Depending on where you're watching and tuning in from, make sure you subscribe to the thing. It helps us a lot. That's because as you subscribe to the podcast, it counts. That's how we are able to semi-count you as a listener. And podcast numbers are still not clear. Sin embargo. I feel like I've been saying sin embargo too much. Pero eso ayuda a que podamos quantify the people that listen. So I do appreciate so much if you are able to subscribe. Rating and reviewing, of course, is super key. It takes virtually 2 seconds. If you can drop some stars, 5 stars are appreciated. If you can drop some words, words are so, so, so appreciated. And through your words is that other people are able to discover the show and share it with others. Y bueno, otra manera que puedes compartir también. You can share this episode and any other episode with your friends, con quien, a quien tú pienses que le puede ayudar. We so appreciate when you do that, because it's also a free way to support the show so we can continue to create stories like this and share stories like this. Y bueno, I would love to stay connected at Café con Pam Podcast on Instagram and Facebook. CafeConPam.com is our site, CafeConPam.com. You can find all the things, all the episodes. You can also find additional stories. Aside from the podcast, remember, we are now doing pour-over stories. We are now sharing exclusive YouTube stories. So make sure you connect with us in all the places. Start at Café con Pam. And then from there, you'll be directed to all the places and spaces. If you are curious about working with me, there are 2 ways to work with me. You can join the Manny's Pass. And at the time of this recording, the Manny's Pass might be on waiting list. Pero add yourself if it is. Or we can do one-on-one work if you are interested in exploring a way to work together one-on-one, if you want to heal your inner niña. If you are looking to stand on your power, own your voice, and do some internal work with your inner niña, inner niño, you're not afraid of the dark. Let's go. Let's work together. Todo ahí puedes encontrarlo en cafeconpam.com. Listeners, thank you so, so much for being here today. I am in my new casita. Thank you for the support as I have been transitioning, and it's been fun. I know last episode I teased this episode. We decided to switch because I'm not ready to share my transition story. So if you were waiting for a solo episode this week, it didn't happen because my body didn't want to. And I listened to my body. So I'm working on a solo episode to share about my transition. But one thing that I can say is this actually came up from a question that a friend asked me because he said he read my latest email. And he was like, how are you doing? Because I read about your transition and how you were waking up by a bird, which is hilarious. And he lives in a place where there's lots of birds. He's in suburbia. And my answer, which was very genuine and authentic, was, well, I think what's been causing me to pause more during this transition is because it was a choice, not a necessity. And I realized at that moment that the majority of my moves have not necessarily been a choice, but necessities. And this time was different. So if you resonate with that, you know that it's a little bit more tender to get to a place of sharing about it. But I will. You want to, listeners. Thank you so, so much for being here today. Stay tuned for upcoming episodes. Y nunca se te olvide to stay shining.